I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome along to a brand new episode of Writer's Routine. This week we are chatting to Mari Hanna, whose brand new novel, The Longest Goodbye, is out now. We talk about why it was the book she never wanted to write. Also, how the experience of working in a prison helped her switch off from the tough parts of being a writer, and why she had three books done in one series without even a hint of being published.
It was because I was having fun. I really enjoyed doing it. When I was writing book one, I never thought about book two or that, you know, even, you know, the difficulty of writing book two, because sometimes book two can be one of those pains that you don't want to. So I didn't have that. I was literally just enjoying myself. At that point, I knew nothing. In fact, the first book, I don't think I really had aspirations to get it published. I was just having fun.
It's all on the way in a brand new episode of Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along to the show. My name is Dan Simpson. This is where we take a look through an author's working day. We see how they get stuff done, how they plan their work, their life, their entire space, to give them the best chance of getting words down on the page. And this week, we are supported by the new true crime podcast, Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? If you love crime writing, storytelling, and podcasts, which is, well, a pretty holy trinity, I would say, considering that you're listening to this, I think this is right up your street. Who is the Cheese Wire Killer is about a 1983 murder, which is now regarded as one of Scotland's most gruesome unsolved cases. Nothing was known about it, not a lead. The killer is still on the run. Until just a few months ago, the police announced the biggest step forward in the case for the past 40 years. And you can be there, front and centre, to find out what's going on. Across five episodes told through a mixture of documentary and drama, the series goes to the very centre of a live investigation. You can be part of it with interviews from the senior investigating officers, forensic scientists, psychologists, even family members and friends of the victim. It's a classic whodunit case that has baffled the police for 40 years. And maybe things are happening. You can be there, as I say, right in the middle, to find out firsthand what's happening. It's such a brilliant twist on true crime podcasts, doing something just slightly different, and I think you'll really enjoy it. You can find the series right now. Listen to the whole lot wherever you get your shows. Search for Who is the Cheese Wire Killer and try and solve one of the most famous murders ever. I don't know if you saw this piece with Sir Philip Pullman this week. Sir Philip wrote his Dark Materials, but a really storied, legendary British author, really. He appeared on another, probably inferior podcast called Young Again. It's with Kirsty Young for the BBC, which is odd as he's repeatedly ignored my emails. But anyway, he is there. And I saw this and it drew to my attention a question that really is at the heart of everything we do. He said, when I go to schools and I hear that children have to make a plan first and then write your story, it fills me with despair because that's not the way it happens at all. I say to them, look, write the story first and then write the plan just to follow the story. Sir Philip remembers starting the first novel the day after his final exams at Oxford University, which, I mean, that's knowing what you want to do in life, isn't it? He says, I thought the whole thing to do was to make a plan. I should make a plan. That's what writers do. They do that. They write the book. He says he tried that and made a wonderful plan, which took him about 6 weeks. It was pages and pages. But then I was fed up with the whole thing and threw it away and started a novel out of nowhere, just not knowing what was going to happen. And he's followed that lead ever since. And as I say, it just gets right to the heart of what we do. And I think it really brings to mind, with what, over 300 episodes of this show now, all the different authors that have been kind enough to tell us the way they do their things, that there isn't one way to skin the cat, right? Whatever you do, whatever works for you, might be the way that you carry on. And if anything, this podcast just serves to maybe give you more advice, more inspiration, maybe just a little pointer to say, oh, perhaps I could do that too. Anyway, I really want to get Sir Philip Pullman to come on the show soon. I saw that and it made me think of you. And now let's get on to this week's guest. It's Mari Hanna, who has just published a brand new novel, lots of award wins and nominations in the last kind of 15 years of writing. She won the Northern Writers Award, the Polari First Book Prize, the CWA Dagger and the Library Award, most recently Capital Crimes Crime Book of the Year. There have been 4 Stone and Oliver books, 2 Ryan and O'Neill books. The new one is a Kate Daniels thriller. Those are getting turned into a TV series too. It's called The Longest Goodbye. And it's inspired by the day that she thought her partner was harmed in the line of duty. She gets a lot of inspiration from her partner, a police officer for 30 years. In fact, Kate Daniels, the character, was one of the first lesbian detectives in a major crime book series. So a lot of inspiration. And this gets quite deep. We talk about the moment Mari thought the worst had happened to her family and how a little while later she had to get that down. We also chat about series writing, how she thinks about characters and arcs in the long term. Also about the detailed precision that is needed when thinking about all aspects of crime, really. And we chat through her murder wall and the toolbox that moves with her through the series. There's a lot going on, so let's dive in with Mari Hanna. And we start it off, as we always do, chatting about what she sees around her in the place where she sits down to write.
I am sitting in my office. I've got my proper murder wall behind me, which is a great big whiteboard where I plan my stuff. And trees that are going like mad outside the window. Lots of festival lanyards hanging on the back of my door, and a police hat that belonged to my partner when she was in the police.
So that's it sounds busy, Mari. It sounds like
it's quite busy. It sounds and lots of books, obviously.
Yeah.
Reference books.
It sounds like there's a lot going on. Do you find that kind of cozy compactness helps you out? It's because I speak to some authors who really like it to be sparse, almost clinical, whereas you sound not like that.
No, it's cozy. It is a really cozy. It's a quite a small room, but it's big enough for me, and it's a great place to get away from everything. I have to say that when I started writing, I just could not write without absolute silence and nobody around me. And I've just launched book 15. So, I've grown up a little bit and can actually write everywhere that I, if I'm on a plane or a train or what have you, or in the kitchen, or, I'm not so precious about locking myself in the room and just, head down. Although I do that if I'm concentrating really hard on something like a copy edit or what have you.
Let's run through the murder war then. I'm imagining something I might see in a police drama on telly, with photos, with red lines drawn everywhere. Just if I were to look at it, when you are in the midst of writing and you're fully into your planning, just how would it look? Just run us through some stuff that I might find there.
Well, obviously, I'm a series writer, so therefore I know who my team is. I don't need to write down the personnel, but it would have the main characters around a sort of central point, which would be the motive for a murder. And then I would draw little bits in under each character, what I'm expecting them to do, what have you. And so I'm just trying to work it out like that. But also, you know, when I go through a book, I tend to make the same, I always have the same tools with me when I start. You know, and I sometimes use a card system when I plan a book, because I am a planner rather than a hunter. But I sometimes use a card system, which is quite good because I can actually decide that actually I'd rather have that scene earlier and I don't have to cross anything out or start typing or anything. I just need to move the cards around. You know, sometimes it's just a list of story beats. I know somebody who used to use a roll of lining paper. He used to tape around his office with color coordinated plot lines. I think you can take it a bit too far, can't you? But yeah, I am a planner, so I do like to have photographs from when I've been out researching and stuff like that. And obviously, I've got copious notes of where I'm going, basically.
It's interesting thinking about the other writer that you spoke to, who's perhaps a bit more colour focused than you. I'm aware that you are 15 books down now, and maybe looking at it in the same way can become a bit staid and predictable. You might not be fully invested in colour, but how much do you do to kind of jazz it up for yourself, just so it looks a bit different?
I used to use different colour post-it notes, to be honest, just to make sure that. If I was working on a document, then I would, you know, I would just highlight them in different colours so that I knew that the main characters were getting an equal amount of time. It's really interesting to do it like that. But, you know, as I said, I have a toolbox that I must have with me before I start writing. Because I'm a series writer, at the end of every book, I update it. And it's like my series Bible, what the TV would call a Bible. It helps me to know of anything that I've changed, because there's absolutely nothing worse than you've promoted somebody in one book and the next book they're back to where they were before. A change of car, change of status, a death in the family, that sort of thing, all goes into the series Bible at the end. And I've got short character biographies that occasionally, because I'm switching between series all the time, that I read through just to make sure that I'm where I should be. One of the documents that people have been kind of a little bit surprised that I have is I always draw off the sunset and sunrise and sunset times. Because obviously when you're writing crime fiction, it's important to know what witnesses can and cannot see at various times of the day, and the various times of the day, the dark and, you know, when it goes dark and when it gets light are very different in the winter than they are in the summer. So I think, you know, for me, it was like really, I need to know that it was possible to see perhaps a glint of a knife across the street, a dark street, or an ID can, you know, be, an offender can be identified when it's dark, basically. When the lights are out. Also, I have, I don't need the phonetic alphabet now, but when I started, I needed that. I know it by heart now, but I think, you know, if you're talking about new writers, I think it's an important thing to grab, to paste onto your wall, and you don't have to go looking for it every time. And then I occasionally refer to my style sheet from, you know, house style and stuff like that, because I have been working with obviously different editors from different publishers, and their style is very different. And then obviously the research notes and the photographs are really important to me.
That level of precision, you mentioned, but not just the phonetic alphabet, but knowing about the times of the mm-hmm. sunrise and sunset. Is that something that's mm-hmm. always been with you when you were writing, or did you kind of discover that a few books in that, oh, this can't do that, this can't do that? I just wonder.
Yeah, I think when I first started, I didn't have any of these things. But as time went on, I realised that actually it's great to just pull them off. You can pull them off the internet. I mean, even if you're writing about sort of 10 years ago or what have you, you can go and pull it off the internet. But also, I sound like a bit of a control freak, really, but I'm not. I create four documents as I work through every book. The timeline, as I go through the book, I need to keep my eye on the time. And I think you ignore that at your peril, because you can get, yourself in such a mess otherwise. It's a useful tool because it enables me to see at a glance what day of the inquiry we're on, what day of the week we're on, because it's no good sending somebody out to see someone if they're closed on a Sunday, or you know what I mean? You can't just walk into a bank on a Sunday, can you? Well, you can't walk into a bank now, let's face it, on any day. But also it shows me how the days that have elapsed since the murder investigation began. So that was the kind of the timeline. But I also have what I call a raised action sheet, so I know which characters have been given what job, so what the job is, which detective or CSI or whatever has responsibility for it. Because if you set something up and you raise an action, at least in the police sense, an action, early, and then you have to like think about paying it off later, you don't want to be keep turning back and finding, well, who did Kate Daniels give that to? Which officer was responsible for that? So if I just note it down as I go along, it helps me. This is very, very similar, but slightly different. I've got like what I call a setup payoff sheet. I absolutely hate loose ends, and readers don't like them either. You've set something up as part of the narrative, and then at the end, people are asking, "Well, what happened to that bit then?" That's not good. So that is how I know that I have actually finished the book off properly. I treat it much like any other job. I get up in the morning, I have breakfast, I get to my office, or even if I'm sitting at the kitchen table that day. Depends what I'm doing and the level of detail I need. If I'm writing something that I've not written before, police-wise, procedure-wise, then sometimes I need to be at the kitchen table because my partner, as I say, was a murder detective. She will talk to me about it. I'll say, am I right in thinking this or that? And if I'm not, if I'm wrong, then she'll say. I always know where I'm going, basically. Once I start a book, I keep going. I write, I write chronologically. I know some writers don't. I remember seeing P.D. James once, and she used to get up in the morning and she used to say, I fancy writing this scene, and it might be like, in the second act of the book or whatever. But I don't. I always know where I'm going because I'm reading. I read through what I've written the day before and edit that before I carry on, because my mind is one of those that I can't move on until I know what's behind me is okay, if that makes sense. And so, yeah, I just carry on and, get a walk in if I can. And if I'm really in the zone, that doesn't happen until much later in the evening. But I work until I'm satisfied. And usually at the end of a chapter when I've delivered a good hook and into the next one.
So you're not a writer that works for a word count. It's just a point that you're happy to stop typing for the day.
Yeah, I never bother about word counts. And actually, they kind of worry me sometimes when I hear people say, oh, I've done 8,000 words today. I go, that just doesn't compute in my head at all, because I don't really take notice of it, but I think I couldn't write that many words if I tried. Because you've probably realised that I do like the detail's really important. And if the detail isn't right, I will rewrite that scene, that chapter, whatever, and rewrite it and rewrite it until I'm ready to move.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting because you are... Oh, but we'll come to this in a second, but you have been like pretty prolific over the last, 14 years or so. Come the end of the day, because your partner was a detective, you said, and I know that you have experience there too, and that you're writing mm-hmm. about this work. Come the end of a day, when you have stopped writing, how possible is it for you to switch off your brain from that story just because it seems all-consuming around you?
Well, it's really odd because I think I, when I was a probation officer, for 3 years I worked in a prison, which could be fairly full on through the day. So I was working in a prison that people were serving 6 years to life imprisonment. So you can imagine the kinds of offences that they committed against children, against women, murder, rape, you name it, I was dealing with every day. And I had about a 35-minute ride home. And in that 35 minutes, I needed to get rid of that and carry on with life and greet my kids and just be a mum until the next day when I went into the prison. So I don't know whether it's that, but I do feel that once I've logged off, close my computer and put it away, put it on charge. I don't look at it again. I don't think about it again. Obviously, in the back of my mind, I'm kind of, I think you're always planning what you're going to do next or where you're going to go next. But it's, I'm not, it doesn't consume me after I close the computer. I want a life as well as, I want to be a writer. But I also want a life, and that was good training for me, I think.
Now we get quite technical on the show. People are interested in software and that kind of stuff. So do you care about what software you're writing on, what font you're using? Just run us through that, Mari.
Well, I'm working on Word, and I don't really like writing with New Times Roman, what you're supposed to write in and what have you. That's how I used to start off. And then I realised quite early on, I think, that my eyes were better if I was in Avenir or if I was in, what's the other one that I use quite often? There is another one. And it's quite light on the page because my eyes don't really like sort of bold. So it's quite a light font. Mm. And that goes to my editor like that. And they've never worried about it because obviously when it goes to the copy editor, she's going to change the font anyway. So, so that's what I do. I write on Word. Don't use any technical programs that have little notepads all over the place, and I know some people do, but I've just thought, do you know what, by the time I learn how to use this, I may as well use Word and just make my own stuff up.
But yeah, you've got all those around you on your murder wall just behind, right? And now, as I mentioned, you have been like pretty prolific, 15 books over the last 14 years.
It was 2012 the murder war came out, so mm-hmm. it's less than it'll be 12 in April.
I was told that this was your 15th book.
It is, but it took me such a long time to find an agent, first of all, and a publisher, that I'd already written the first three Kate Daniels novels before I was published. So when a publisher saw my first one and realized I'd written three, Pam Macmillan offered me a three-book deal, and they brought them out one every 6 months until those books were done, so that they grew my audience quite quickly, which is why, I mean, I think people think that I'm a very, very quick writer, I must write like 100 miles an hour. I don't. I'm very I think I'm quite slow. Like I said, 8,000 words would be unachievable for me. But then I'm not writing a dirty draft. I'm writing, by the time I get to the end of a book, my first draft is just about ready to go to my editor and my agent. So I'm not going back to the beginning and then editing. I'm editing as I go along.
Well, it's interesting that you had written three before you managed to get one published. I think so many people would write one and would campaign, lobby really hard for that to get out there, and then maybe when it didn't find a place, would become a bit disconsolate and forget and completely switch up what was going on. Why write three books in one series before any has been published?
Well, I'll tell you what, Dan, it was because I was having fun. I really enjoyed doing it. When I was writing book one, I never thought about book two or the difficulty of writing book two, because sometimes book two can be one of those pains that you don't want to, So I didn't have that. I was literally just enjoying myself. And eventually, and that was wonderful, because that was before, I love speaking to people like you and doing events and festivals and talking to journalists and what have you. But at that point, I knew nothing. In fact, the first book, I don't think I really had aspirations to get it published. I was just having fun. And that continued. And as I said, it took a long time to find an agent and an editor. And even after I got an agent, it wasn't that easy, because Kate Daniels is a gay, or she was in the closet completely. And I think, publishers, it's easier to say no than yes. If there's a perceived risk, which is amazing to think about. In my head, I couldn't believe that. And I actually remember once saying to my agent, look, if I'm wasting my time, please tell me. And he said, no, you crack on, just keep writing. And we did, and I did. And strangely enough, Germany picked me up before the UK did. And once I had the German deal, and my second book had won an award that I put in locally here. We have something called New Writer North, the organisation that writes with new writers. And so the second book, before it even found a publisher, had won an award. And it was brilliant, because it actually won the award as the first book was on the desk of the publisher at Pan Macmillan, who's my first publisher. So that was great.
Yes, so you're there, you're ready to go, aren't you? And you said that you wrote those first three because you found it fun, and now, well, this is your job.
I still find it fun.
Well, that was my next question. Was there must be ups and downs, but you've kept going and you've published quite a lot. Like, where does the drive come from when it isn't very fun? Like, because there must be times when it's another.
Oh God, there is. There's loads of times when it isn't fun. When, you feel like you're a lone voice, really. I mean, I think that the perception from my point of view of other writers who I know, obviously I know lots of writers now, and, my perception of their success is often very far from the truth. When you talk to them, they're just as frustrated as I get occasionally, that I'm not getting the push that I would like. And it's not an equal world. I'm Northern, I'm gay, I'm a woman. What more do you want to sort of push? I'm successful. I've won awards. I've won a lot of awards, but I'm not in the thick of it. I'm not, publishing is very London-centric. I know they're trying now to have regional offices and what have you. But at the beginning, when I started, it was very difficult, very. And that's only 12 odd years ago. Or maybe, it's more like 14 years if you count the time that I was trying to get published and I was finding an agent. So, it was a very lonely place to be. And I think, I think for Northern writers, they do kind of stick together. We've got some super writers up here now. Anne Cleves, who was with Pam Millen when I joined, was very, very generous to me, giving advice and what have you. It's like everybody else who starts off. I had no idea what was coming. And suddenly, you're pushed into the limelight. You're on a stage and people are looking at you and you go, oh, God, this is just so different from sitting in my office having fun. And so it's been a long curve, a learning curve for me. And I've enjoyed it. But as I say, there have been very, very big ups. And, equally, there have been times when things haven't gone quite so as I'd hoped.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
One of Scotland's most notorious unsolved murders.
I was the first scientist to open up these items that had been stored by the police since the time of the crime.
And it's always been in my mind for over 40 years that I could have found the guy responsible.
I firmly believe that somebody out there knows something.
Who is the Cheesewire Killer? Listen to the full series now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Who is the Cheesewire Killer is supporting the show this week. Make sure you listen wherever you get your shows from. And you can support the show over on our Patreon page too, if you fancy. If you have had any tips, advice, help along the last 300 odd episodes that just made you think about the way that you do things, I hope we've given some help. Well, you can give help back to us. It's just me that does this every week, more or less. I like to bring you a chat with a different, wide and varied author as often as I can. And by supporting us on Patreon, you can just keep that going on. It doesn't require a lot, a little bit every month. It gets you merch, there is bonus content, there is even a way, as I say, for your book to properly sponsor the show. So if you've released something, if it has not had the plugging, the press and attention that I'm absolutely certain it deserves, well, let me talk about it for you. To make that happen, do give a thought to supporting the show over on our Patreon page. I know times are tight, so it doesn't take a lot. Have a look and you can get involved at patreon.com/writersroutine. Let's get back to it with Mari Hanna then. In this part, we chat about the rules of genre, also her experience working in a prison and how that gave her an insight into criminals and helped her perhaps switch off from the tougher parts of writing crime fiction. And we pick it up with that new novel, The Longest Goodbye, talking about why it's a book that she never wanted to write.
In some ways, this was the book that I never wanted to write, because it was born out of an experience that I had a long time ago, just after I'd met Mo, my partner. I think we'd been in a relationship about 2 years, and I was home. And I heard the tail end of a broadcast on the radio, which was saying that a young policewoman had been shot in the back. And I was like, whoa. And, you know, it was just a moment when I think it was the very first time that I, you know, I'd thought that my partner would go out and like not come home or not come home in the same condition. And I was like, oh my God, you know, and I rang her office. I spoke to a detective who told me he didn't know where she was. She was out. And I certainly, you know, in my head, it was her. It was definitely her. And I thought, this is the police closing ranks. They're not going to tell me anything. Of course, you know, when you're in a relationship, there was civil partnerships weren't there then. So I didn't have any like legal right to any information or anything like that. But I put the phone down, and actually a few minutes later, Mo rang me and said, it isn't me. And I thought, God, what if? So, sorry, you can even probably hear me getting a bit emotional about that. So for years, I locked that away. And every time somebody in the police is killed, really badly injured. This person was called Maureen as well, which was awful. I mean, they were both Maureen. They were literally years apart in age. And she didn't die, but she was very, very seriously injured and ended up in a wheelchair forever. So I pushed that away. And every time I heard about another police death, another this, that, and the other, it used to like eat away. So. And then I thought, who better to write this than me? And so I thought, I can feel, as you can probably tell, yeah, I can feel that emotion. And it's an emotion that I have given to Kate in The Longest Goodbye. So I have invented her, a best friend, who was killed in the book. She was killed 3 years earlier. So in the book, we start with a prologue where Kate is rushing to the scene, hoping that whoever's told her from the control room that her friend Georgina Iannou is dead is wrong. And she blodges away, and Kate's a bit of a, you know, she usually says what she wants to say and does what she wants to do. She's not a rebel, and she doesn't break the law, but she sometimes breaks the rules. And she barges her way into this crime scene and has a row with the SIO on the way in, and she just must see for herself. And so that's the prologue. And then we cut to 3 years later. She is not involved in the investigation of Georgina's murder at all. And that is explored in the book as well. But we cut to 3 years later when the prime suspects for Georgina's death arrive back from Spain, sneaking into Newcastle to see their parents on Christmas Eve. And they are shot on their doorstep. So we've got two completely different investigations going on. As it happens, when the book is set, Kate's boss, Bryce, has gone away, and she stepped into his shoes. And what happens is her sidekick, Hank Gormley, he takes on the double murder that I've just talked about. Mm. Two young guys from a very renowned crime family. So he deals with that, while Kate has to now prove, despite the fact that the suspects are already dead, that they actually did kill Georgina, if that makes sense. Because you can't just say, well, they were the prime suspects, that's it. You know, it still needed to be proved before the case, the cold case, as it happens, would be closed. So it's very traumatic for her. She obviously knows the family really well. She knows, the kids. Two of the Georgina's kids are also cops, and obviously there's a big nobody cares. You know, the police officers don't really care about these two guys who've been murdered. They all have these two guys fingered for Georgina's death. And so you could almost say that the whole of the force is actually a suspect, but especially the kids and the family of Georgina. So it was a really emotional book to write. Don't worry, Dan, I wasn't crying all the way through, but it was a really, really emotional book to write. All of the bloggers that have read the book have said, oh my God, this is her best yet. This had me absolutely in shreds of tears or what have you. And that's a good thing, because that's how it should be.
So because it's such an emotional subject and you are feeling not just your own emotions, but going through it again with your lead, Kate. But you've got a plot, you've got to plan this, right? Because of how meticulous you are. So when you decide, okay, I'm gonna revisit that and I'm gonna tell this as a novel, what do you do between that decision and writing the first sentence? I'm talking about planning the whole thing, using the post-it notes on your murder wall. Just run us through those questions you're asking and how that process works.
Well, I think first of all, I had to decide where this was going to happen. And so I was out in the car driving around. I there was a couple of places that I hadn't really visited while I was, through the series and the other series that I write. And so I eventually chose Rothbury, which is a place that I really love, in North Northumberland. And, I spent a long time walking up and down the riverside there and thinking about it and thinking, well, if she lives here, this is where this is where she will be found, very close to home, which again, kind of like, hints at, was it the family, was anything to do with the family, this, her killing, never mind the other people, the other two involved. Yes, I chose the location first, I think. But I mean, I knew the story I was going to tell, and I knew which way I was going to tell it. And we feel Georgina, because there are quite a few flashback scenes, because it was important to, I think, for people to understand where that relationship came from. And Georgina was the first officer on Kate's first night shift. She was roughed up a bit and she was taken to the station. And Georgina was the officer that saw her there and took a hit off her and sent it off for forensics and gave her advice and one thing and another. And I'd written that as a short story, actually. And it went into a little anthology. And I think once I had that, and once I realised that I wanted to bring Georgina back to life, if you like, then I was going to have a few flashback scenes. And we see Georgina, happy, on holiday, stuff like that, as we go through the book. And you get to feel that really special relationship between the two women, as well as, the grief that goes with it. So, yeah, that's kind of how I started. And I do a lot of thinking when I'm wandering around, when I'm running around talking into my phone and people think, oh, she's a mad woman, keep away from her because she's just, these days it's not so bad because everybody's doing it, aren't they? They're walking around talking into their phones, talking to people, whereas I'm not actually talking to anyone. I'm just talking for my own benefit, just making notes, which I transcribe when I get home.
Yeah, it's much easier to get away with it. Well, listen, last question. You've done this for quite a while now, but you're writing in a specific genre. How much do you still have to actively think about the conventions of that genre and what readers expect from like a procedural crime novel?
I think it comes really automatically to me, but I once wrote a standalone called The Silent Room, which stepped out of that in a way, because the officer was suspended and went dark, and that was fun. I really enjoyed that. And I'm actually thinking that I might do another standalone for the next book. I've already written the next Stone and Oliver book, which is being edited now. And yeah, I think I like to do that, give myself a little break and write something completely fresh. And actually, this time I might write it with my partner. She should be on the cover of those books as much as me, because she does feed in a lot of, you know, her experience and my experience, and we chat a lot about it. She's very involved in that side of things. So I think we might write one together. I'll probably be doing the writing and she'll be doing the ideas, but we'll see.
And that is it for this week's episode of Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Mari Hanna for coming on the show. The new novel is The Longest Goodbye. It is out right now. We'll be back with a brand new episode and author next week on the show. If you are not following and subscribed, make sure you do that. A really easy click so the episodes download to your feed every week. You can support us on our Patreon page, patreon.com/writersroutine. Drop us a follow on X at writerspod there and get in touch. Use the contact page at writersroutine.com. We are supported this week by the new true crime podcast, Who is the Cheese Wire Killer?, which you can listen to wherever you get your shows. The whole series is there right now. And that'll be it for this week. See you in a few days on a brand new Writer's Routine.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.